The following program, Normal Show Live, is intended for responsible adults only. We advocate for the repeal of marijuana prohibition for adults. We discuss the science, culture, and controversy about America's marijuana laws. We do not advocate or encourage any illegal activity and advise all listeners to learn their state and federal marijuana laws by visiting normal.org, N-O-R-M-L.org. Opinions and claims made by guests and advertisers of Normal Show Live are their own and do not necessarily reflect the philosophy and policies of Normal. Listener discretion is advised.
You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it,
and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
From the promise of legalization.
And I think we need to rethink and criminalize our marijuana laws.
To the agony of prohibition.
Well, on the earth.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws presents.
We love the earth.
Normal Show Live. Marijuana Nation. Now, here's your host, Normal's Outreach Coordinator, Radical Russ Belville.
Good afternoon, tokers and tokets. It is Tuesday, January 4th, 2011, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Thanks for joining us here for the show. We're glad to have you here for our first show of 2011, and I want to apologize to the listeners out there for not having a show yesterday. I made a big mistake. I thought January 3rd was the New Year's Day holiday this year. Turns out it was December 31st of last year was the federal holiday for New Year's Day of 2011. Confusing, huh? So we did a show on Friday. We didn't do a show on Monday. I apologize to everyone for that. But note for the future here, we do not put a show on the days of federal holidays. So just check out January 17th. That will be Martin Luther King Day. We won't have a show on that day or any other federal holiday, just to let you know. All right, joining us here in the studio, of course, is my good friend and the pirate, the maestro, Ganja John.
What's up, guys?
How was your weekend?
It was fun. We had a good time here.
Oh yeah, we had a little New Year's Eve party right here at Rolla J Studios. A good time was had by all. Damon and Jen were here, and a bunch of other folks. And the Quad Perk was here.
Quad Perk.
We love the Quad Perk. You ordered one of those, I understand.
I ordered one after the party. Yep.
Oh boy, that's going to be a fixture right here at Rolla J Studios. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Also joining us from our virtual studio in beautiful Grastoria, Oregon, is the lovely and talented Cannabis Carrie. Hi, Carrie.
Hello, everyone. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I'm sorry I messed up on the show scheduling yesterday.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. No problem at all. It happens.
Okay. Well, we've got a great show coming up for today on this Tuesday. At 30 past, we're going to talk with Paul Armentano, Normal's deputy director, and take a look behind the headlines. You may have heard of the recent push in the state of Colorado for per se DUID legislation, and you've heard things like 5 nanograms per milliliter and carboxy THC. We're going to get down to what all these things mean, metabolites, active THC, all of that stuff, blood testing versus urine testing. And whether or not this 5 nanograms per milliliter thing is something we should be supporting or opposing or what we can do about it. So that's coming up half past the hour in our Behind the Headlines segment. In Radical Rant today at 45 past, we're going to talk a little bit about New Year's resolutions and some of my resolutions for Normal Show Live coming up in this wonderful year of 2011. At 20 past, we're going to talk with Cannabis Cure UK, who has got us our Electric Tuesday Daily Toker Tunes. At the 2 o'clock hour here in the Pacific time, we're going to go to Normal Show Live's Toker Talk Radio and take your calls and talk about the new year. But before all of that, we've got to get to our hemp headlines with Cannabis Carrie. What's in the news today, Carrie?
Well, it's been a while. Saturday is dawning a new day in California. We're going to talk about that. Also, an interesting case out of Washington State that pits parolees against the medical marijuana laws, and a case in Oklahoma, Russ, one of those smash and grabs, if you ask me, but we're going to talk about that case as well.
All right. Great stuff coming up on today's Normal Show Live. Please stick around, and remember, you can get the first hour of this show podcast as the Normal Daily Audio Stash, available on iTunes, out on our blog at stash.normal.com. stickemnormal.org. The second hour is live only for those of you listening on Stick'em Normal Show Live. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Normal Show Live, the voice of the Marijuana Nation.
In today's busy world, we're inundated by advertising for all types of pharmaceuticals that come with a laundry list of potential side effects. Shouldn't you have better medical choices? Natural alternatives to pills pushed by Big Pharma? At Alternative Medical Choices, you could choose natural, safe, and effective alternative therapies that are right for your budget without nasty side effects. Cannabis, or marijuana, has been a legal medicine in the Pacific Northwest since 1998. Our doctors will help determine your qualifications for a medical marijuana recommendation in Oregon, no matter where you live. Our massage therapists will ease your aches and stress with soothing hemp seed oil or cannabis-infused massage salves. We also offer acupuncture, Reiki, and other alternative health therapies. Call Alternative Medical Choices in Portland, Oregon at 503-288-5579 or visit our website at www.altmedchoices.com. We specialize in out-of-state recommendations. That's www.altmedchoices.com or call 503-288-5579.
You want to legalize it? Call your congressman today. 202-224-3121. It's free, it's easy, and you don't even have to give your name, just your zip code, and they'll hook you up to your congressman. Call 202-224-3121 and tell Congress you support marijuana legalization.
Liberate your mind, liberate your mind. Liberate your mind.
Medical marijuana, industrial hemp, consumer cannabis. It's time for this week's Normal News with Cannabis Carrie.
In California, cannabis might not be legal to the general population, but as of last Saturday, the penalties associated with getting caught with a small amount is the equivalent of a traffic ticket. Outgoing Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a marijuana decriminalization bill back in October, and it went into effect on January 1st. If you are in the state of California, the legal status of marijuana possession up to 1 ounce or 28 grams will no longer carry a threat of jail time. What had been a misdemeanor of less an ounce of cannabis is now an infraction and carries a maximum penalty of only $100. Since it is now an infraction, violations will not appear on any criminal record. Arnold Schwarzenegger signed Senate Bill 1449 into law a day after he penned an op-ed piece in the LA Times. In that open letter, he said he was strongly against California's push to legalize marijuana with Prop 19 and that reducing the crime of possession was the answer to many problems with cannabis laws in California concerning those adults that use cannabis outside of the state's medical marijuana program. Decriminalizing cannabis 1 month before California's historic vote to legalize the substance gave those on the fence a reason to vote against Prop 19, according to many activists. Governor Schwarzenegger had vetoed several marijuana law reform bills during his time in office, so the passage of Senate Bill 1449 took some by surprise. California did fail to legalize marijuana for adults in the state by popular vote, but many advocates are claiming a victory by the decriminalization of cannabis in the state to protect citizens against unreasonable punishment for possession of what amounts to a personal amount of marijuana.
Well, this is one of those good news, bad news sort of situations. Of course, the good news is that we finally have real decriminalization in the state of California. And I believe this would not have come about without the pressure of Prop 19 on the legislature and on the governor. They kind of took a look at it and said, well, you know, if we allow this to happen, you know, it's going to be much more legal than we want. So let's just throw them a bone. Let's throw them a little decriminalization here. And that'll undercut some of the political support. A lot of what the support for Prop 19 was originally had to do with the fact that California, while marijuana possession under an ounce wasn't an arrestable offense, it was still a misdemeanor. So it still had all of the baggage that would come along with a misdemeanor, the criminal record, the having to go to court, probation, drug testing, all that kind of stuff. So getting it down to just a $100 infraction ticket is a good thing. Let's not overlook that. However, on the bad news side, this is one of the things I fear in the fight for marijuana legalization, is that by going about this incrementally, by getting these incremental gains, we'll reach a place where there are enough people that are satisfied with the status quo that there won't be very much momentum for moving forward with legalization. We kind of saw how introducing this decrim, signing this decrim, kind of cut the legs out from underneath Prop 19 in some of the support, like Kerry said, among people who are on the fence. Between the ability to get a medical marijuana recommendation for just about anything in the state of California, it can be a really, you know, quick trip for most people at a reasonable cost for those medical recommendations. And with the proliferation of dispensaries where these people can go and purchase quality marijuana, combined with others who don't get their medical recs only getting a $100 ticket now, it's going to be harder and harder to find people in California to really put forth the argument that it needs to be more legal than it already is. And of course, it does need to be more legal than it already is, because all decrim means is that the people who are producing marijuana, the people who are selling marijuana, the people who are distributing marijuana still get felonies, they still get crimes. Only the final end purchaser here, the consumer user, is protected by this $100 ticket. We need to legalize all the way around, or else the prices never come down, the patients still have to prove that they're not criminals, and the people who are using marijuana will always have trouble with accessing it, because the people distributing it and growing it still have to fear that felony. Let's legalize for everyone. Don't take your eye off the ball.
And a fascinating story from the Seattle Times this week. Several times a week now for the past 2 years, Washington State felons on supervision have asked the Department of Corrections for special permission to use medical marijuana. The requests are signed by doctors with reasons such as chronic pain, anorexia from AIDS, or to suppress the side effects of chemotherapy, among others. The State Department of Corrections has turned down nearly all of the requests. The ongoing debate in a state that has recognized medical marijuana as a treatment option for many for 12 years now is whether policing felons includes meddling with their medical treatments. Pressure on the Department of Correction has been increasing as more and more patients enroll in the state's medical marijuana program and as society's attitude about marijuana changes. Public opinion shows that increasing favor for legalizing cannabis for adults is continuing to rise. Recent estimates show over 100,000 people in the state are enrolled in the medical marijuana program, and about 5,000 citizens make a living off of medical marijuana businesses. But the Department of Corrections, according to advocates, is ignoring the state's medical marijuana law by substituting its judgment for that of doctors who are allowed to recommend cannabis use as a medical treatment. The department contends that many of the requests for waivers to use medical marijuana come from offenders with drug histories, and claim that the public expects the department to help those folks return to the community. Scott Blolin, a Department of Correction Assistant Secretary, who began the internal discussion in an email back in 2008, says it is incongruent for the department to allow some to use marijuana when it led to their criminality in the first place. But a Tacoma physician, Dr. Scott Havsey, protested when the Department of Correction denied his patient's use of marijuana to treat intractable pain from multiple herniated discs, saying that after his recommendation, the department is not following the law. A group of advocates, attorneys, physicians, and patients say the policies of the Department of Corrections is ripe for a legal challenge, although none have been filed yet. The DOC's chief doctor, Dr. Steve Hammond, says that mainstream clinicians gravitate toward traditional and conventional treatments rather than marijuana, and he contends that most of the notes he has seen come from just 3 or 4 clinics that he refers to as authorization mills. Since the law prohibits medicinal marijuana in prison, the issue is typically those out on post-prison supervision. Up until now, many probation officers would just ignore positive drug tests if the offender had a doctor's recommendation. But the question remains, should the DOC uphold no drug provisions in criminal sentences, or should they show mercy to sick offenders and follow the medical marijuana laws of the state? The oft-sued agency has expressed fears that it would be liable if an offender on supervision were to hurt someone while high on marijuana, approved use by their agency. So far, the Washington State DOC has taken a firm line against the medical use of cannabis by offenders. Since July of 2008, 320 offenders have requested waivers, which are reviewed by the department doctor, but subject to appeal within the DOC. Dr. Hammond has approved just one request. 6 others were okayed on appeal. Now, waivers are not needed for prescriptions for Marinol, a synthetic form of THC approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat nausea and appetite loss.
Yeah, this story illustrates perfectly my point from the last story about the need to fully legalize marijuana or else patients continue to have to jump through ridiculous hoops. This is one of them. We don't see the Washington Department of Corrections getting involved with the medical treatments of people on probation for any other prescription drug. You don't see Washington DOC getting upset about OxyContin or Vicodin or Percocet prescriptions. And even for people that, you know, they mentioned, oh, people might have gotten in trouble with the law because of drugs or drug abuse in the first place. Look at the prescription drug abuse rates in this country, the abuse of OxyContin, Percocet, Vicodin, these heavy-duty narcotic painkillers. And yet, we don't seem to see the DOC in Washington having any problem with probationers getting those prescriptions from their physicians. Here we have medical marijuana, the safest possible treatment, the least addictive of any of the substances that people use recreationally, and a superior medication to many of the medications that are prescribed for these people, like the AIDS wasting syndrome and the cancer chemotherapy. Cannabis is the number one anti-emetic out there. Ask anyone who's ever had nausea and had to use medical marijuana to keep it down. They know for sure. So for us to be denying 320 people this life-affirming medicine, this safe and non-toxic herb, just goes to show you again how medical marijuana doesn't go far enough. It's a second-class medicine, and the people that use it are second-class citizens. It's not treated like any other medicine, including the prescription dronabinol, the Marinol pill, the synthetic THC that is 100% potent. This is why we need to continue moving forward with legalization, or else patients will always be treated this way, people on probation will always be treated this way, there will always be a need to separate the patients from the criminals.
A traffic stop in Oklahoma back in August of 2008 netted an empty duffel bag, some fabric softener sheets, a large roll of trash bags, and one white bank envelope with $14,000 in cash. Now also found marijuana residue in the ashtray of the car and on the pants of the Illinois man who was a passenger in the car. Since the residue, duffel bag, and cash were all found in the same place, the officer seized the cash since it was thought to be tied to a drug crime, according to an affidavit. State Trooper Jor Kimmins said he found the items in the trunk of the car he stopped for failing to use a turn signal when exiting the freeway. He noted that the driver seemed nervous, and he also smelled marijuana smoke in the car. Well, now, 2.5 years later, the stepfather of the man with the marijuana residue on his pants is trying to get the money back that he says is his and is not tied to drugs in any way. A lower court had thrown out the stepfather's previous claim to the money, but the State Court of Civil Appeals has ruled that he deserves his day in court, and it is the state that should have to prove that the money was, in fact, drug money. The stepfather, Brooks Burr, has said that the money was given to his stepson to buy coins for him at a rare coin show. Burr, who is 61, is a rare coin collector and zoology professor at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. His attorney says the troopers had no good reason to take the money and called it literally highway robbery. They pull you over, they take your money, calling it pure coincidence that the money was in the car at the same time the stepson had drug residue on his pants. A prosecutor dismissed a felony drug money possession charge against the stepson after Burr produced records showing that the money was withdrawn from his bank account the day before it was seized by a state trooper. But despite the dismissed charge, an attorney for the Department of Public Safety said the agency still believes the cash was drug money. The state claims that the two men stopped that night are recorded in the back of the patrol car discussing getting their story straight about the cash. A new court hearing on the matter has not been set.
Well, once again, another illustration of why marijuana needs to be legal. The mere residue of cannabis on a baggie in your car or on your pants itself is enough to justify law enforcement taking your assets, folks. It's civil asset forfeiture, and normally in these situations, you have to prove the money or the cash or the car or whatever it is they're seizing is innocent. Until you have to prove it's innocent, right? It's guilty until proven innocent. This is a rare step here where this civil court is saying the state has to prove that that $14,000 came from a drug transaction. In most cases, you have to prove that the money didn't come from a drug transaction. This is what we live in America as cannabis consumers, where merely the way we smell or the residue on our clothes can be enough to take our property, to put us into a cell, to lead us through the entire legal system. system. Really, folks, the punishment isn't jail. The punishment is having to go through the legal system. And imagine trying to hire yourself a lawyer to defend your freedom and defend your property when the cops have seized all the money you would use to hire a lawyer. This is the insanity of the war on drugs. It's a war on our own people, and it is a war on our civil liberties.
I think it may be time for a Hashplant break.
Hashplant break, the first break of 2011. We'll celebrate with some number two OMCA Hashplant. We're right back after this.
It's 20 after the hour, and we have to take a short break, if you know what I mean. Please support these sponsors who support Normal Show Live.
Oh, have you ever met that funny reefer man? A reefer man. Have you ever met that funny reefer man? A reefer man. If he said he swam to China, he would send to South Carolina. Then you know you're talking to that reefer man.
When I was in England, I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
I think you'd probably be a lot cooler if you had, Mr. President.
Said, hey, do you have a joint case? Sure would be a lot cooler if you did. Lie to don't hide it. Well, lie to don't hide it. Just lie to don't hide it.
Ever wonder how often to change your bong water? The most effective method for making pot brownies? The best destinations for a ganja getaway? How to hide herb in your car? Whether to grow your own? How precisely to legalize it? Or how something as wonderful as marijuana ever got to be illegal in the first place? Finally, you can find all these answers and much more in the official High Times Pot Smoker's Handbook, featuring 420 things to do when you're stoned. Since 1974, High Times Magazine has covered marijuana in all its aspects and wonders, from cultivation to legalization to the herb's enduring and exalted place in popular culture. Packed with inside information, the official High Times Pot Smoker's Handbook wove all of his collected wisdom together into a single indispensable ganja guide, including an entertaining look at marijuana's history, profiles of herb-friendly travel destinations and festivals, favorite potluck recipes from the High Times staff, smoking skills, advocacy and activism, essential marijuana movies and songs, profiles of famous cannabis strains, comprehensive growing information, celebrity endorsements, and much more. This is truly, finally, the ultimate guide to green living.
It's time for your Daily Toker Tunes, the best in 420-friendly music from all genres that uplifts, entertains, and informs the public. Our PodSafe music is donated by freedom-loving musicians who support our goal of ending adult marijuana prohibition. Today we bring you tunes for Electric Tuesday, our segment featuring the best of modern electronic music in the genres of dance, new age, house, and electronica, brought to you by Greg in Surrey, Sussex, England, and Cannabis Cure UK. If you'd like to submit your song to be played on Normal Show Live, send it to us at stash@normal.org. Now, here's some great independent marijuana music for today's Daily Toker Tunes.
Welcome to 2011, Tokers. This is Cannabis Cure. I'm bringing you Electric Tuesday for Normal Show Live. Today I have for you a remix of a well-known classic that has been totally transformed into some dirty, grimy dubstep remix. Static DJ's Rick Mitchell from South Ogden in the United States is representing the dubstep and the drum and bass community. Static's music isn't just for the club, he says. It's to pay tribute to the things in his life that have put music in the front of his act. Of his work, he says, my productions are always breaking boundaries on what can be, should be, and shouldn't be used in electronic music. You can find Static's links to the SoundCloud he has and his Facebook at thestash.normal.org. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' Last Dance with Mary Jane will probably never sound the same again. I'm fine with that because this track was an instant winner for me. Hope you enjoy it too. If you haven't lit that joint yet, I give you permission to do so now at Josh Woody 420. Thanks for the back. This is kind of cool.
Thank you.
At the Stash blog by surfing to stash.normal.org and choosing media and then Toker Tunes from the main menu.
Starfish Designs, makers of the original Gandalf.
I'm Radical Russ, and when I want to relax, I always have my 17-inch long original Gandalf from Starfish Designs nearby. The hand-blown borosilicate glass is strong and easy to clean, and the design is sleek and sophisticated. Starfish Designs are available from Bend, Oregon at a glass retailer near you. For locations, call 541-788-GLASS. That's 541-788-4527.
In terms of legalization of drugs, I think that the battle, the war on drugs has been a utter failure. And I think that we need to rethink and decriminalize our marijuana laws.
Normal Show Live, where we don't change our position on decriminalization in an election year. Normal has been the place to go for the latest studies and news on marijuana science, policy, and activism. For over a decade, one man at Normal has written and reviewed more studies and news stories regarding marijuana than most anyone on the planet. First as senior policy analyst and now as deputy director, Normal's Paul Amentano has written for major newspapers, academic journals, and magazines on the subject of cannabis and is frequently requested as an expert witness in the courtroom. His knowledge and experience are an amazing asset to the cannabis community. Available to you now in a segment we call Behind the Headlines with Paul Amentano.
Welcome back, Tokers and Tokettes, and we're getting into a subject that is a very important one that we need to start talking about here in the cannabis community, and that is the concept of toking and driving and the idea of how much is too much and when are you too impaired. All of these things are something that has been studied in depth by our Deputy Director, Paul Armentano, who joined us by telephone from the Bay Area. Paul, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Russ.
The reason I wanted to bring you here is we've been speaking a lot to our friend John Doe with John Doe Radio. He's in Denver, Colorado, and he covers the cannabis community there. And they're all worried about this proposal in Denver, or in Colorado, excuse me, in the state house there, to set a per se 5 nanograms per milliliter of THC in the blood as a per se stoned driving limit. And, of course, this leads people to bring up all sorts of things they think they know about drug testing and driving, people saying things like, oh, well, marijuana stays in your system for 3 weeks and all these other things. I thought I'd bring you on here to get down to the science of this. So let's start by explaining what they mean by per se DUID.
Well, a per se statute means that society at large has set a limit. And if a person is over that limit, regardless of the totality of circumstances, by simply being over that limit, they are judged under the law to be in violation of a criminal statute. Now, most people are likely aware of per se statutes because currently the United States has a 0.08 blood alcohol statute for drunk driving. This is a per se standard, so it says that any driver who operates a vehicle with alcohol in their blood at a level of 0.08 or higher is considered per se guilty of drunk driving.
Right.
This means that the state does not have to establish through field sobriety testing or other means that the person is actually too impaired to operate a vehicle. The state has already met its burden of proof by simply showing that the person was driving the vehicle and that they had this level of alcohol in their blood. So a per se marijuana statute would take this same principle but apply it to the detectable presence of, in this case, THC in the blood. And it would say that if a person is operating a vehicle and they have THC in their blood at or above this limit, then that person has violated the drug driving statute, and the state does not have to go any further to actually establish that the driver was in fact impaired to drive, because they have violated the statute by simply getting behind the wheel with this amount of THC in their blood.
Yeah, and I think that's something, even with respect to alcohol, that we should always be aware of, is I think people think of the breathalyzer and DUI statutes with the 0.08 BAC, they think of that as preventing drunk driving. What they're really doing, though, is just preventing people from having X amount of alcohol in their system, whether they're drunk or not.
Yes, exactly. These laws really aren't about traffic safety per se, including the blood alcohol per se laws. They're about making the prosecution of certain drivers more easy for the state to win these cases. It's quite difficult for the state to establish beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that an individual has gotten behind the wheel and for whatever reason they're too impaired to drive. There's many ways the state goes about prosecuting these cases. We have field sobriety examinations. We have drug recognition experts that take a coursework that teaches them how to identify if a person is impaired behind the wheel. There's physiological exams. We measure persons, whether their pupils are dilated. We measure how their pupils follow the officer's finger. We do balance tests, walk and turn tests. We measure their pulse rate. We do blood and urine testing to determine whether certain substances or byproducts of certain substances are present in a person's drug, present in a person's body. We bring the police officer who was at the scene who says, I pulled the person over because they were weaving or they were driving erratically. And they present all of this evidence in court, and the totality of that evidence either establishes to a jury that the person was reasonably was impaired beyond a reasonable doubt, or the state fails to meet that burden of proof. But it's a fairly high burden of proof, and as you can see, the state has to take a lot of time and effort to gather all of this information to be able to make its case in court. And what these per se laws, for the most part, are about is really just lowering that burden that the state has to meet. Because once you pass a per se law, as long as you have a blood test that establishes a certain level of a certain compound is present in a motorist's blood above a certain level, the state doesn't have to do anything else. Because the statute says that by simply having gotten behind the wheel, whether the person was demonstrably impaired or not, they have broken the law. And we can see with the alcohol laws how inconsistent these can be. It wasn't very long ago that many states said you had to have a blood alcohol content of 0.10. to be per se guilty of drunk driving. But then the federal government lowered the threshold to 0.08. If you look to Europe, several countries have much lower drunk driving thresholds. Many countries in Europe use a 0.05 blood alcohol level as a per se drunk driving. Sweden uses 0.02 as someone who above that level is considered to be per se a drunk driver. So it's not, even when we're talking about alcohol, as if there is a consensus among scientists at what level the person should per se be considered too drunk to drive. And that is the risk that would also be involved in setting a per se statute for marijuana. I can see why some lawmakers would like a one-size-fits-all sort of statute, but right now the science really doesn't indicate that there is such a threshold, nor do I believe there is a need to establish such a threshold. It's right now illegal in every state for a person to operate a motor vehicle impaired by marijuana, and I think the present statutes that are on the books in those states, for the most part, are working just fine.
Mm. You know, it seems to me that these per se limit laws, even with respect to alcohol or marijuana, aren't so much about preventing impairment on the roads. It's more like a way of saying we're going to make illegal irresponsible drinking or irresponsible smoking. And the idea being that if you've had 3 or 4 or 5 beers, you shouldn't get behind the wheel. And maybe the idea with marijuana, if you've had 3 or 4 or 5 bong tokes, maybe you shouldn't be behind the wheel. Let's talk about the science behind this, because this is a real concern of many people, especially those of us not in the choir. A lot of the people out there in the mainstream voters have bought into the idea of the alcohol breathalyzer, and they want some sort of similar magic machine when it comes to marijuana. Now, first, we should establish that we're talking about THC in the blood here, because I get a lot of people that comment about that, you know, marijuana can stay in your system for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, but they're talking about urine there. Let's clear that up first.
Sure. There are two, when we're talking about marijuana and drug testing, we're typically talking about two primary components. We're either talking about THC or we're talking about carboxy-THC. THC is the psychoactive substance in marijuana. Carboxy THC is the inactive byproduct. It is what THC is turned into after it is metabolized by the body. Now, THC has a relatively short half-life in blood. THC levels spike almost immediately after inhalation, within minutes. So a person experiences their peak THC blood levels within 10, 12 minutes after smoking marijuana. And then those levels dissipate very quickly, and typically within 3-4 hours, they're really not even present in the blood at all. Or if they are, they're at such negligible levels that only the most sensitive testing equipment would detect them. So we're talking about a substance that has a fairly short half-life and that has peak blood levels that are in many ways proportional with the person's euphoric experience. The higher the THC blood levels, the more, the greater association there's going to be with heightened psychoactivity. The lower those levels, the less psychoactivity the person's going to be experiencing. Much like blood alcohol levels, they rise and fall proportional to the to how intoxicated the person is by alcohol. By contrast, carboxy THC is an inert metabolite. That means it has no psychoactivity associated with it. Carboxy THC is typically detected in the urine. It is stored in the fat tissues, which means that it has a much longer half-life. It can be detected in urine in infrequent users for a couple of days. In frequent users, it may be detectable for days or weeks or even months in very heavy users. But when we're talking about many of these per se statutes, like the proposal in Colorado, we're not talking about carboxy THC. We're talking about THC in blood. And as I noted earlier, for all but the most extremely heavy users, this has typically a very short half-life. And that's why a standard like this 5 nanogram per milliliter proposal, for the most part, is a standard that would only identify fairly recent users of the drug. And by recent users, I mean individuals that have consumed the drug within the last few hours.
Okay. So in a state, you know, if Colorado goes forward with this, then basically medical marijuana patients and recreational users will just have to get to the used to the idea of no driving for 2 hours after use.
Sure, and that's frankly a rule that I think most responsible users ought to follow to begin with. There is psychomotor impairment associated with marijuana. I know there's many consumers within our community that don't like hearing that statement, but if you look at the evidence that has been put forward on this issue, and there's quite a bit of it, we do see that in 3 or 4 different types of performance tests, we do see some impairment associated with the use of marijuana. We see what's known as a standard deviation in lateral positioning associated with recent use of the drug. That's essentially a complex way of saying that the driver weaves. They don't keep the driver's side tire parallel with the median on a closed road test. We see some adverse effects in peripheral vision or tracking. That means the driver is quite focused and aware of what's going on directly in front of them, but they have more difficulty responding to circumstances that may be taking place within the peripheral vision. We also see some adverse response to when they have to respond to things in front of them that require the use of depth perception. We sometimes don't see the sort of time response that we'd like to see under circumstances where the driver is sober. And many of these instances are dose-related, and that's something I'd really like to stress. In low doses, we see very nominal effects on performance, but the higher the doses are, the greater the adverse effects. The other key that I'd like to point out, and a study came out about 4 or 5 months ago that really hits the nail on the head with this, is that we see greater adverse performance associated with more naive users. And we see less adverse of performance on these sort of psychomotor tests when the user is more experienced. It seems that when users are frequent users of marijuana, they do become tolerant to some of these adverse effects. Now, that's not to say, hey, if you're a frequent user of marijuana, you should just go ahead and go out there and drive on the roads. But it is an acknowledgement that there seems to be greater risk of accident when we're talking about more naive users behind the wheel. The final point I'd make, and this has been some data that's been consistent for years now when these tests are done, is that when alcohol is consumed in combination with marijuana, we seem to see an exponentially adverse effect on driving. And what I mean is the driver performs tasks at a level that is far worse than when the driver is using marijuana alone or when they're using alcohol alone. Mm. So those are two substances that should never be used in combination prior to driving.
Okay. We're speaking with Normal's Deputy Director, Paul Armentano, an expert on the subject of drug driving, DUID laws and such. I wanted to quickly give folks a kind of an overview of what's going on in the United States. We're talking about Colorado adopting a 5 nanogram per milliliter of THC in the blood per se standard. Above that limit, you would be a stone driver subject to punishment via the law. There is another state with this standard. Pennsylvania has a 5 nanogram per milliliter in the blood standard. Ohio and Nevada are set at 2 nanograms per milliliter, and the states of Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, and I believe Rhode Island have a zero tolerance of THC in the blood. Any THC they find in the blood makes you per se a stone driver. And then with respect to urine testing, we talked about the inactive carboxy THC metabolite. Illinois, Indiana, Georgia, Utah, Arizona, and Delaware, and South Dakota have zero tolerance for those metabolites that show up in pee tests. And in the states of Georgia and Arizona, it's 24 hours mandatory jail time. And in Utah, 48 hours mandatory jail time the minute they detect that. So compared to what some of the other laws are on the books, 5 nanograms per milliliter in blood doesn't sound that bad, Paul.
No, and let me be clear about what this means, because some people are under the false impression that if, say, a state like Colorado passed the statute, and they would then, as you noted, have a statute similar to what's been the law in Pennsylvania now for many years, that somehow inversely implies that if you're driving and you have levels of THC in your blood under 5 nanograms, that somehow is not a criminal offense. That's not the case at all. That simply means that if a person was pulled over and say they test positive at 4 nanograms of THC in their blood, that the state can still bring DUI charges, but that the state is going to have to go about making their case through those more conventional and traditional means that I spoke about earlier. The state will have to perform field sobriety testing. They'll have to bring in a DRE. They will probably do a physiological exam, and they will have to make their case that way. So even when these statutes are passed, even when they have thresholds, this does not mean that there's some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card
right. If
you're simply under the threshold. As I noted, it's already illegal to drive impaired by marijuana in every state. It's just that some of these states, quite frankly, are tired of losing these cases in court, and they want to make it easier for them to win these cases, and you do that by simply setting this per se threshold. Now, I will note that there is some data available in the scientific literature showing that if we're going to try and estimate a THC blood level for impairment, that 5 nanograms is roughly around the level where we do begin to see some significant elevated risk of accident when drivers try to operate a motor vehicle and their THC blood levels are above that limit. Now, it's an estimate. It's not a perfect limit. It's not necessarily one I would even agree with on some sort of one-size-fits-all sort of statute, but I do want to make people aware that this isn't a number that's just been pulled arbitrarily out of the air, but
right.
In fact that there is some scientific consensus indicating that if we're going to go down this road, this is a fairly fair place to start. And I was involved in a limited degree to the discussion discussions that were taking place by this committee in Colorado that proposed this per se limit. And I would like to let a lot of listeners know, particularly the listeners in Colorado, that if it were not for the input of one or two people on this committee that I was in touch with, this committee would have come out of these meetings setting a much lower per se threshold, a threshold around one or two nanograms, which is what was initially being proposed. And as you noted, that's the standard that's in Ohio and Nevada. That is not a scientific-based standard. Those were numbers that were picked arbitrarily by lawmakers simply because at the time the sensitivity of the equipment that is used to test for THC in blood could not go below 2 nanograms per milliliter. That's why that standard was set. Even in those states that claim the standard is zero, technically the standard isn't zero there because the testing equipment that is used cannot go down to zero. It could only confidently go to 2 nanograms.
Okay. And, you know, with respect to that per se limit also, I mean, it's the same idea we have with alcohol where they say, you know, just because you don't blow a .08 on the breathalyzer doesn't mean that you're not impaired when you're driving. You know, the same logic would apply to a per se standard with cannabis. One last question and we'll let you go here, Paul. I have a lot of people in the chat room who are medical patients who are bringing up, you know, the other medications, OxyContin, Ambien, all these other things that people get prescribed. Are there any states that have per se limits for prescription medication? Is there a need for such a law or such testing?
This varies from state to state. There are not states that I'm aware of that have per se limits for specific medications, but there are plenty of states that have statutes that say if you are impaired by the use of a prescription medication, you are in violation of the law. And then where this is particularly an issue is with the benzodiazepines, which clearly impair driving performance. We're talking about drugs like Xanax, that are quite popular both by prescription and also sometimes used illicitly by recreational users. They cause serious issues on the road. States are aware of this, and many states will prosecute drivers if they're driving erratically and it's determined that they are using these substances, whether they're prescribed or not. If the use of that substance has impaired your ability to drive and the state can establish that fact in court, in most states that's against the law, whether you're a legal prescription user or not.
All right. Paul Armentano is Normal's deputy director and a recognized expert in all of this stuff about drug testing, cannabis, and driving. He's also the co-author of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? And I think we'd both acknowledge that the drinking drivers are probably much more of a danger than the cannabis drivers. Is that true, Paul?
Yes, and I think one of the issues where I think marijuana and driving in many ways gets a bad rap from the general public because the general public is very aware of the way alcohol adversely affects driving, and they're not aware that marijuana can affect driving performance, but it affects it in very different ways. Alcohol tends to make people more reckless drivers, more aggressive drivers. It tends to elevate their use of speed and weaving and making reckless decisions on the road. Marijuana, in contrast, is generally associated with more cautious driving, driving at a slower speed, leaving a greater room between your car and the car in front of you. So while they both affect driving performance, alcohol tends to affect driving performance in ways that make the risk of accident much greater than does marijuana. So what we tend to see is that drivers under even low levels of alcohol, including legal levels of alcohol, tend to have a much statistically higher risk of accident than drivers who are found to have even very high levels of THC in their blood. But of course, the safest driver is the driver that does not have levels of alcohol or marijuana in their blood. And the studies really do bear that out.
All right. Paul Armentano, you're a wealth of knowledge. We could talk to you all day, but we're going to let you go. Thanks again for joining us here on Normal Show Live.
Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
marijuana and alcohol are the two most popular recreational drugs in America. Marijuana smoking is non-toxic, relatively safe, and has a low risk of dependence. Alcohol drinking is potentially fatal, dangerous to society, and is quite addictive. Marijuana is safer, so why are we driving people to drink? That's the question of the new book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? By Paul Armentano, Mason Tvert, and Steve Fox. Visit Amazon.com or ChelseaGreen.com today to order your copy of Marijuana is Safer, or visit MarijuanaIsSafer.com.
You want answers?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
You want answers?
You have offended my family.
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
And you have offended Shaolin Temple.
You can't handle the truth.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Radical rant.
Welcome back, Tokers and Tokettes, and not so much of a rant today, but a happy New Year's wish to everyone for joining us here at Normal Show Live. We've got so much planned for you in this upcoming year, and I just want to let you know some of my resolutions for Normal Show Live this year, for New Year's. First resolution, I'm working on a book. It is tentatively titled The Normal Big Book of Marijuana Facts, The Science and Statistics for about Cannabis and Its Consumers.
Whew.
There it is. But the short title, The Marijuana Big Book, yeah. Or Normal Big Book. And a really cool idea that I had an epiphany with this, is that I was just going to take the graphs and charts that I use for my presentations and make a book out of the presentation. And I found a way that we can do it, make it 11 by 17 paper. And they have these easel, they're called easel binders, that they fold up like a triangle, and they have the little sheet protectors, and you can flip fold them, right? Yeah. And so I'm writing the book in such a way that the graph will face the audience, the big graph will face the audience, and then the other side that would be facing the presenter will have the bullet points and the script and all the notes and such.
Right.
So that you could use this as a normal chapter. You could set this on your table at the Hemp Fest, or, you know, at the rally or the expo, wherever you might be, the march, and be able to dialogue with people and show them these graphs, because, you know, you don't always have like a computer monitor or a projector or any of that crap around.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
Yeah, and also sell it electronically so that it can be a PowerPoint presentation. People can download the graphs. It's going to be a great setup. I think the books will end up costing about $40 because it's going to be full color and it's going to be large size. So
right.
It's going to have to be something that, you know, you invest in if you're a chapter. So that's one of the resolutions. Another resolution, I'm continuing on with the, I'm stealing from Howard Dean here, the 50 state strategy. It is my goal to have a normal affiliate in all 50 states. We've got them in 24 states, state affiliates. Now, we do have some local chapters in some of the other states, but a state affiliate's bigger than that. They take much more responsibility for organizing the entire state. If you're interested in organizing Normal in your state, send me an email at stash@normal.org, stash@normal.org, or if you just want to get the information straight to you, just email start@normal.org. And finally, we are building the Normal Network, and by the end of this year, I sure hope that we have got the shows put together and the servers and all of the infrastructure put together to give you a 24-hour all-original programming network here from Normal and our friends at John Doe Radio, Grateful Dread Public Radio, and some of the other great podcasters that are out there in the cannabis community. We're going to make it happen, and I know you'll help us do it. If you got any ideas or advertiser suggestions, send them again to me at stash@normal.org. For Cannabis Carry and Ganja John, I'm Radical Russ from the Normal Foundation. This has been Normal Show Live. Stay tuned for Hour 2. We're live. We'll be right back. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
We love it.
We love the earth.
This is Normal Show Live, the voice of the marijuana nation.
You grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.